This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, the mother of science fiction, the life of Mary Shelley.
Okay, so this week is my fault.
This week is entirely Madeleine's fault. And you know what? I really admire the way that you have combined tasks here. Rather than giving yourself two separate workloads.
That makes it sound like I'm being lazy.
No, I'm not being not lazy. At all. Look, it's work smarter, not work harder.
Basically, I teach a module all about the Gothic, and Mary Shelley is obviously one of the points of focus that we look at. And I recently put together a lecture all about Mary Shelley. And as I was cobbling everything all together, I just got steadily more excited and more impassioned, to the point that I think a lot of people were starting to get a bit tired of me turning around just going, God, Percy Shelley was such a dick. And a lot of people were like, okay, can we talk about something else? And I'm like, no, I need to get this out of my system. So eventually and the nice thing was that if I said it to Jules was like, oh yeah. And we got really into it. And then I was like, wait, hold on a second. If we're talking about this anyway, we might as well bring it up in a Dissecting Dragons episode, not least because we talk about speculative fiction. And let's be honest, when you think of the Gothic, you think of Mary Shelley. And she's also the mother of science fiction. So it kind of seems appropriate.
Definitely. I think what sometimes escapes some people is the fact that a lot of sci-fi has its roots in horror. And, you know, all these things sort of came together. And last week we didn't really mention this because we were too focused on talking about cursed objects. Mm-hmm. But this is, and yes, we're starting it in September because we can do what we want. we are starting our run-up to Halloween, to Samhain. And we're just really excited to provide you with lots of creepy episodes. So this really fitted into that general theme.
Definitely. And yes, the moment we're sort of halfway through September, once my birthday has passed, I'm like, right, it's Halloween now. Slap hands on desk. Nothing else.
It's Halloween. We're going to celebrate it for 6 weeks. Enjoy it. Enjoy it, guys. It's the Celtic New Year.
Yes. So we're going to be doing these increasingly spooky episodes. And yeah, it really did feel like a good place to start with Mary Shelley.
Yes. So first of all, just a little bit of an intro as to why we might want to talk about Mary Shelley, because I think pretty much everyone has heard of Frankenstein, mm-hmm. the novel, obviously, also known as the modern Prometheus. Most people will know that it's written by Mary Shelley, but what they might not understand is the peculiar circumstances of Mary, or at least unconventional circumstances of Mary Shelley's own life. Mm. And there's a lot to talk about, but just as a brief overview, she basically created an entire new genre when she was just 19 years old.
Yeah, and it was just a kind of a side thing as well.
Yes.
Just they were on holiday, it was raining lots, so they were just, so a group of them, including Byron, because Byron's always somehow involved. Whenever there's shenanigans afoot, Byron was lurking.
I mean, obviously we'll get into that in detail a bit later, but
yeah,
she thought she was writing a short story, and, you know, I really feel her on this, because a lot of the time I think I'm writing a short story and it also turns into a book, so I identify with that.
Yeah, and she just started something entirely new, as well as adding to the already growing and very rich Gothic tradition as well.
Yeah. It's also worth thinking about when she was a 19-year-old girl writing this very unusual fiction. And it was the fact that she was born in the late 18th century, obviously yeah. lived into the early 19th century. And things were just becoming that bit much more oppressed for women. I mean, they hadn't been great before, but, you know, we were starting the era of the Victorians.
Yeah.
And, you know, genuinely she was sort of in the Regency era as well. And it was just... She was a very intelligent person who had had quite an odd education.
Mm.
And she sort of personifies someone who takes both her mother's attitudes towards certain things, again, which we'll go into later, and her father's political, philosophical attitude towards things, and has come to her own conclusion and gone in her own direction, and no matter what sort of censure was thrown her way.
Yeah. Yeah, she was certainly a very intelligent young woman, and she, as we said, she had a very peculiar education, and a lot of very peculiar and, you know, slightly, well, quite modern points of view thrust at her. And there was, of course, a massive double standard, which she then had to deal with. Whereby people could say, oh yes, we believe in this thing. But when it was put into practice, they started to get itchy. So there was, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. But she lived an incredibly unique life. And she was very thoughtful. She was very philosophical.
Yes. And, you know, if that isn't enough to make her kind of... you know, a gothic writer's or a gothic sci-fi writer's dream. She had a lot of tragedy early in her life as well.
Mm.
I wouldn't say she was defined by other people, but all of us sort of leave fingerprints on each other, if you know what I mean, emotional fingerprints.
Yeah.
So these early losses and disappointments and things, and the fact that she still held firm to her own view rather than conforming for an easier life says quite a lot about her, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And we will sort of give a brief overview of her life and the events that happened in it, not least because you can definitely see a lot of the trauma that she faced echoed in Frankenstein.
Yes. Obviously, Frankenstein wasn't the only thing she wrote. She wrote some poetry, she wrote some other short stories and things. I don't think she ever wrote quite as successfully or as forcefully, perhaps is the word, as she did with Frankenstein.
No.
Or perhaps it hasn't found its audience yet, which is entirely possible. But she was incredibly foresighted. I mean, this was a time when science was burgeoning as a study, and she was clearly at the forefront of trying to take on board and digest things rather than clinging to the idea that the church would sort everything out.
Yeah, and I also want to make quite an interesting little observation, which was sort of thrown at me by my father when I was again ranting about Mary Shelley, which is that he started to get confused about the dates of when Mary Shelley wrote the book, because he said, but electricity hadn't been discovered yet, as yeah. it were. And yet she uses it in the book.
Yeah.
And this is this perfect example of sci-fi, is the whole thing of sort of creating something in fiction which then comes to life later on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there does seem to be this incredible level of forethought to her writing, which is just, it's just brilliant when you look back at it within context.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, I mean, we'll try and tackle everything in order, because we could get very excited here and run ahead of ourselves.
Yes.
but yeah, this foresightedness and the classic sci-fi thing of I'm imagining this into being because it's possible, it's plausible, and then later, no, it's not only possible and plausible, it's an actual thing that exists now.
Yeah.
It is something that if they'd had access to more to better microscopes and things, and to an understanding of, you know, why Gregor Mendel's pea plants pollinated the way they did and produced the cross-pollinated blooms and things, Frankenstein might have been written in a very different way. Rather than you know, dead parts of dead bodies stitched together. It might have been much more about genetic manipulation because the themes absolutely fit.
Yeah. But again, the science, well, not of dead bodies being stitched together, but certainly if you think about in the modern day, things like transfusions and, you know, surgeries where you get a new heart, new lungs, organ donation, it's not that far-fetched. Now, obviously, this doesn't involve a lot of grave digging, but then the other thing you have to remember at the time was that this was the era of Hare and Burke. This is the era of the grave robbers, where these bodies would disappear from grave sites. And then, strangely enough, these doctors would have these cadavers very usefully the next day. just brushing a little bit of dirt off the shoulder there and...
Yeah, and obviously it really delves into that.
Yeah.
Let's really get into the weeds, if you like, on Mary Shelley's life.
Oh, yes. So let's start with the fact that Mary Shelley's mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, was a feminist and a philosopher who had actually already had a child out of wedlock. She was a great believer in free love, as it was called. She married William Godwin, and yep, the pair of them were both big characters. They both seemed to be very affectionate for one another, and they had Mary. And then, unfortunately, Mary's mother died very shortly after she was born, which yeah, meant that she was left motherless from an incredibly young age.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, obviously, to William Godwin, he was a political philosopher. He did not believe in this system of government, which, you know, we still have echoes of today, whereby you could not criticise the government. You had to have come from a lordly family in order to speak.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you had to be backed by money. He believed that everybody should have a voice and that power should be carefully applied for the good of society rather than hoarded for the few.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, this basically left William Godwin with two young children, whom he loved very fiercely. He really did love his children, but he wasn't necessarily good with children. Even so, he did his best to give Mary and Fanny, his the other daughter whom he adopted, an education, though he didn't believe in the full education that his wife had wanted for both of her children. Part of this actually involved taking Mary down to her mother's grave and teaching her how to spell her name by having her trace the letters on the gravestone, which is quite a way to learn to spell your name.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a case of, oh, well, this is an easy primer. That stone's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they shared a first name. So, but yeah, to us today, that's certainly a very macabre way of learning to spell your name. Your name is forever associated in your childish mind with death.
Yes. And the grave, her mother's grave would become a very special place for Mary, because it actually started to be connected with education and with debate. It was a place of great comfort. She spent a lot of time there, which is important. We'll come back to it later. But first, let's introduce Percy Shelley.
Now, yes.
May I please ask to go on a tiny, tiny little rant? I shall try and keep it short.
Yes. All I was going to say is Percy Bysshe Shelley was one of Mary's father's political followers initially. That's how they met.
Yes. And William Godwin liked him because Percy was obviously from a aristocratic background and had money. So, little bit about Percy Shelley. Percy Shelley, when he was 19 years old, eloped with a 16-year-old girl named Harriet, and the pair of them got married. Unfortunately, the marriage wasn't going very well, probably because his new wife Harriet insisted that her sister come and live with them, and Percy couldn't stand her sister, and so things got pretty tense in the household for quite a while. Percy was then Percy was then introduced to the Godwin family. Now, he actually initially met Mary when I think she was about 14 years old. There are rumours that he did start a kind of relationship with Mary's older sister, Fanny, and the two were incredibly close with one another and certainly loved debating. They were so close that William Godwin actually decided to send Fanny away, and he sent her to Wales to kind of separate the pair so that nothing bad would happen. This did not deter Percy Shelley, who simply just moved on to the next sister in line. Now, apparently he fell very deeply in love with Mary. He was 21, she was 16. Seems to be a running theme here. Mary's other sister, Claire, was also rather taken by Percy as well. Let's just say the entire Godwin house were rather taken by Percy Shelley. Except increasingly William Godwin, who became more and more suspicious, but still wanted his money. So Percy and Mary kind of really became rather affectionate with one another. But it is said that there are apparently statements that say that Percy sort of really, really kind of declared his love for her, said that he would commit suicide if she didn't reciprocate his feelings. And what happened was that when she was 16, she took him to her mother's grave and she professed her love for him there. He reciprocated, and they then proceeded, apparently, to have sex right there and then, in the graveyard, on her mother's grave.
Yeah, it really does all come back to death, doesn't it?
It really, really does.
I'd just like to point out for the people listening to this in horror and going, ah, paedophilia, that's not quite how it worked in Regency England. And you could, with your parents' permission, get married from the age of 12 onwards. Now, generally speaking, you know, if you're a girl, generally speaking, this didn't happen because no one is going to give a 12-year-old girl a dowry. And also, you wouldn't necessarily have been presented in society, so technically you wouldn't be out in society and therefore considered available as a marriage prospect. However, you were still considered a fully grown woman, or very nearly. Mm. On the other hand, there was also and we know this from Jane Austen's novels, there was a very definite perception of the sort of man who picked very young girls to target in order to get hold of their fortunes. Now, this wasn't the case, obviously, with Percy Bysshe Shelley, because Mary Godwin would not have had an awful lot of money.
No.
But there is still definitely something of the rake. I mean, honestly, he sort of comes across to me, initially at least, as a thoughtless sort of sensualist, somebody who wants what he wants at the time.
Yeah.
And is kind of in love with the idea of being in love. I mean, you only have to read his limp poetry to sort of get that from him.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I also think that one of the reasons that he was attracted to Mary was that there was going to be a varying power dynamic there. Now, Mary was, as we've said, an incredibly, a fiercely intelligent person. But she was also 16. This was a time when she was developing her thoughts, when she was figuring out who she was. And Percy comes flying in there and really starts to push a certain agenda on her. Now, that's not to say that she was weak and she just followed in with whatever he was doing. But you do have to remember, this was a married man. He was 21 years old. She was 16. So even though it wasn't considered really paedophilia at the time, they were considered to be on sort of equal levels. intellectually, on an emotional level as well, they were, there was a power. There was, you know, he was the more dominant power in that particular situation. So, of course, we don't know. We don't know what their relationship was like. We can only speculate. But I'm just very aware of the fact that he seemed to prefer younger women. And whilst he really, really did enjoy a good debate, as shown by the way that he engaged with these things, it must be said that you can sense there's probably an element of ego. And having someone who looks at you, gazes at you longingly and with adoration and holds on to your every word, is probably something that he was quite attracted to.
Yeah, I mean, he comes across as somebody who is incredibly vain and insecure. And, you know, that's something he had in common with a lot of the romantic poets.
Yes.
And we'll get into that a little bit more as we go on. Anyway, as Madeline has said, this great affair with Percy Shelley started. He was not free to marry her.
No.
I think he even petitioned Harriet for divorce, didn't he?
I'm not sure. I think he might have. But the problem was that at this point, Harriet was pregnant. They already had a child together. Allegra, I think her name was. And she became pregnant. So while she was very heavily pregnant, Percy Shelley did the only sensible thing, which was that he took Mary and her sister, Claire, and they ran off to Switzerland together.
Yes. It's worth mentioning, obviously, that Claire Clermont was William Godwin's stepdaughter. So not Fanny, not the older, you know, half-sister that Mary had, but she was the daughter of a working-class woman who William Godwin got married to. And it was another affectionate relationship there.
Yeah.
Claire Clermont was one of Lord Byron's cast-off mistresses.
Yes.
And was quite keen to get back into his good graces, among other things.
Yeah. There's also rumours or speculation that Percy Shelley also had a relationship with Claire as well, and that Claire's child might have actually been his rather than Byron's, but we don't really know. But certainly there seems to be accusations on Mary's part that Claire was sleeping with Percy as well. So it's all a big mess. Anyway, so Percy has run off with 16-year-old Mary, leaving his very pregnant wife behind. She gives birth to a healthy baby boy named Charles. Mary quickly becomes pregnant as well. They return to England, where she gives birth to a premature baby girl who dies within days. This is obviously the start of many tragedies in, I say the start, obviously her mother, but this was the start of what would be a series of very, very tragic situations involving children for Mary. She had four children, and one major miscarriage. And I'll just go over those very quickly. She basically had the first child died prematurely. The next two, she had a son and then a daughter whom she loved very fiercely, and both died within 9 months of each other, several years later. Her fourth child, Percy, survived, and she went on to live with him when she got older. And her fifth was ended in a terrible and debilitating miscarriage that almost killed her. So there was a lot of incredible sadness there. And certainly when you look at Frankenstein, you can see elements of that pain of losing a child, or the inability to bring a child into the world. And there was certainly some jealousy in the fact that Mary had just lost her child, and Percy, meanwhile, was very taken by the new son that he had with his wife.
Yes, and there is also an element, if you think about it, that while Percy was professing his love for Mary, he wasn't at liberty to marry her.
No.
So she was not secure. She was in the position of being the other woman, the mistress, which is never a good or secure position to be in, particularly not during Regency era. And they were ostracized. All good society kind of cut them out. They particularly cut Mary out because obviously it was her fault as the other woman for tempting this upstanding young man to go astray and leave his wife in such a circumstance. And yeah, they lived together, but they were struggling with debt and with the fact that they, you know, they weren't welcome anywhere. And it was a very unpleasant time. So not only had Mary been bereaved so recently of this premature baby who died only a few days after being born, she had no real support. So, you know, the sort of gentle sympathy that all women in that situation would have extended to each other. And bear in mind, this is the time of the serial pregnancy. This is a time where they're gradually starting to crack down on those women's pills that stopped women having babies too close together, that on the idea that it was a woman's business whether she decided to go ahead with a pregnancy up until she was 5 months pregnant.
Yeah.
Men were starting to crack down on that. So she did not get any of that support she would have got from the Society of Women of her own class.
No. She was even turned out by her own father, who refused to receive the pair, though again, he still wanted Percy's money. This actually also caused a lot of friction between her and her older sister, Fanny. Now, Fanny had been called back from Wales and basically had been left to pick up the pieces after her two younger sisters ran off. The household became increasingly tense, with debtors at the door, and she kind of bore the brunt of all of her father's anger. She also didn't have a very good relationship with her stepmother. Her loyalties were divided because she wanted to offer comfort to Mary. She wanted to help Mary. But she, you know, she also was still loyal to her father, who had adopted her, who had raised him, raised her as his own, and, you know, whom she was, she held a great affection for, despite everything. Eventually things got so bad in the Godwin household, she began to beg Mary and Percy to let her go with them. Percy, however, perceived her to be a spy for Godwin and refused. And unfortunately, Fanny became so distressed by this increased terrible sort of tension and misfortune and sadness in her life that she killed herself by an overdose. Very shortly afterwards, in the same year, Harriet, Percy Shelley's wife, who had become pregnant with potentially another man, they think it might have been someone who was in the regiment, also killed herself. She drowned herself. The same year, Percy and Mary then got married, right at the end of the year. Now, you might think that's incredibly callous. They barely waited until she was, you know, cold in her grave before they jumped into marriage. But again, you have to consider the fact that Mary was in a very precarious situation, and actually the only way to kind of save themselves now was for the pair to be officially married. So yeah, they did. But of course, this marriage was following the suicide of a wife. So there were a lot of very, very unpleasant rumours. And of course, Mary bore the brunt of the blame. Nothing to do with Percy, who abandoned his wife or anything. No, no, no. It was all Mary's fault that this woman had committed suicide. And so even though things alleviated a little by them getting married, it wasn't actually much. Reputations had already kind of been ripped to shreds.
Yes. Now, before they got to the point where they could actually get married, something significant did happen. A little bit of a sidestep here, but in 1816, Mount Tambora basically blew its stack.
Seriously?
Seriously, the top of the mountain disappeared. So Mount Tambora erupted. There was a huge amount of ash that was blown into the atmosphere. This is why they called it the year without a summer. And it was a summer, it was a year of terrible storms. It was cold. It was, you had frost during what would have been midsummer. The sun seemed to go down at around midday. The birds would go back to their nests at around noon because it was already getting dark. Terrible, terrible lightning storms would rage across, you know, the northern part of the hemisphere. And within all of this, Percy and Mary, who were not at that point married, together with Claire Clement and John William Polidori, who is Lord Byron's personal physician, were all holed up at Lord Byron's invitation at Via Diodati on the edge of Lake Geneva.
Yeah. And this is actually quite significant for today's episode. Because there they were, all hauled up. They couldn't really go out. They couldn't really do anything. So what did they decide to do? They decided to tell ghost stories. And they were each challenged to sort of write their own.
In fact, I think it was Lord Byron who set the challenge initially. This challenge happened, this story always amuses me. This story happened because it was a particularly dark night and Mary and Percy weren't going to go back across the lake to their own villa because it was so stormy. There was, you know, it was literally lightning coming down onto the water, so it probably wouldn't have been very safe. And Lord Byron says he'll entertain them, he'll have candles brought in and he will do a reading. And he did a reading of, I think it's Coleridge's Christabel, which is about this terrible vampiric woman. And Percy Bysshe Shelley got so frightened of Lord Byron's reading that he screamed and ran out into the storm. Anyway, this got everybody...
That's amazing.
It amuses me greatly. This got everybody thinking. I think this went on from there, where you have friends together at a house party or, you know, a writer's retreat and everyone's taking the piss over somebody overreacting to something. With Byron saying, oh, I could write something as frightening as this. And Mary saying, well, actually, I think I could write something as frightening as this. And Percy not to be outdone by his mistress and Lord Byron's cast-off mistress, who wasn't there actually to do any writing. But there's always someone at a writer's retreat who isn't there to do any writing. Said, oh, yeah, you know, I can obviously, I can best both of you. It's interesting to note that Percy Bysshe Shelley never actually finished anything at that particular time. And also, John William Polidori, the doctor, had literary aspirations as well, which was when he wrote The Vampire. And since we won't be coming back to Polidori anyway, we'll mention the fact that for years, because Byron was banished from England at this point in time.
Yes.
For various issues, not least of which was apparently having had an incestuous relationship with his own sister. And various political things and debt, you know, the young noble romantic gentleman's time-honoured tradition of gambling cards, too much women and lots of laudanum. And so Polidori, he was very paranoid about his health, was Byron. So he travelled everywhere with a personal physician, which is weirdly flash. That would be weirdly flash by today's standards. It was very weirdly flash back then. Polidori loved serving Byron because he wanted to get into literature, and it's one of those sort of like, ah, you're a big name in the field, please introduce me to your agent or your publisher, as it would have been in those days. Polidori did end up submitting his book The Vampire to Byron's publishers. Byron's publishers were under the misapprehension that the book was written by Byron, and John Polidori let them get on with publishing it under Byron's name. So for years, The Vampire was thought to be written by Byron, even though it wasn't. It was written by Polidori. And obviously Byron couldn't go back and say, I did not write that pile of crap, that is not my work, because he couldn't return to England. So Polidori sort of ate out on Byron's reputation.
That's brilliant.
And I, you know, normally I'd be kind of like, well, that's a shitty thing to do to another writer, but it's with Byron, and I just think, you know, it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, really.
Like I said, whenever there's shenanigans about during the time, Byron was involved. So there they were. They were all sort of writing their ghost stories. And again, Mary had already had obviously had lost a child at this point. There had been her sister had committed suicide, I think, already at that point.
Possibly. Yeah.
And so, you know, there were all these things that were kind of crowding in on her. And she wrote Frankenstein, which I think the official term is Percy Shelley then kicked through a thesaurus. anyone who says, oh, it's way too wordy, that's Percy Shelley's fault, not Mary's. And yeah, they kind of they went from there. And so this is the birth. The birth of Frankenstein was a bunch of people all locked in a house mocking each other because it was stormy outside. I couldn't think of a better way to start a story.
Yeah, absolutely. So we get Frankenstein, which is the birth of modern sci-fi, and we get the birth of the modern vampire novel, because no matter what you think of Polidori's work, and it is patchy, to say the least, it does show some ideas that clearly writers such as Bram Stoker drew upon later. With great disaster, such as The Year Without a Summer, can come great creativity. We all know that, but it's interesting to see it illustrated. Yeah. What's worth saying at this point is that Mary was unfortunately subjected to a great deal of sexism. She was 19 by this point, when she wrote Frankenstein. And 2 years later, in 1818, it was finally published. And there were two subsequent rewrite and updated editions. And a lot of the book was then attributed to her husband, because no one could quite believe that this young girl had come up with it. And even scholars today will, you know, look at the original manuscripts in the Bodleian and say, you know, clearly look at Percy Bysshe Shelley's notes on this. Clearly he must have at least co-authored the book. Honestly, if you go and look at these manuscripts, Percy Bysshe Shelley's line edits are less than you would get from a friendly beta reader. Mm. He didn't really do anything. I think your description of kicked it through a thesaurus is actually fairly accurate. It's like, let's add a bit more drama by saying ejaculated rather than said. So, by the way, nowadays it's not okay to say ejaculated as a form of speech tag. Just want to point that out.
And yet, if you read any Sherlock Holmes, there's a fair amount of ejaculation happening. Professional
on-page ejaculation. it's really annoying. It's a bit like the theory that Branwell Bronte actually wrote all the Bronte novels. It's this endemic sexism in literature that suggests that women could not possibly produce something, a stunning work of startling originality, without a man at least holding her hand and probably writing most of it for her and saying, there you go, love, put it under your name.
Absolutely.
Which is obviously utter bollocks. And Mary Shelley refuted it quite stringently in life and said her husband actually had nothing to do with that book other than encouraging her to get it published.
Yeah, absolutely. It also makes me think of Shakespeare. The whole, Shakespeare couldn't have written it. I mean, it's just clear classism, and that's all there is to it. So classism and sexism have obviously played a big part in censoring writers for a long time. But Mary did push on anyway, and fortunately, for the most part, most people believe that she did actually write the book. No one really wants to consider that this 19-year-old girl could possibly have written one of the cornerstones of Gothic literature, and one of the main, you know, one of the celebrated books of English literature, but she did, so deal with it. Mary's life didn't really get much easier. So as we said, she did lose several children. Her little boy and her little girl both died when Percy Shelley suddenly went, let's move to Italy. And during the move, both of them, again within 9 months of each other, died. Then she did have little Percy Jr. And then finally she had this miscarriage. And at this point, Percy Shelley has the audacity to write these letters out to people just saying sort of, oh, woe is me, my wife is so cold and, you know, unresponsive towards me. And I'm like, I don't know, Percy, could it be something to do with the fact that she's just had a major miscarriage that almost killed her, that she's lost several children, and that you're still sleeping around with other people? Do you think that might be it, Percy? Do you think maybe that might be affecting her mood just a tiny bit? I'm not saying Percy was a whiny little bitch, but Percy was a whiny little bitch.
Oh, Percy was absolutely a whiny little bitch. I invite anyone to read Percy Bysshe Shelley's poetry and then take a step back, take off the rose-tinted glasses that sort of like, oh, the great romantics of the era tend to put on you, and really look at what he's saying. Because a lot of what he's saying is, I'm horny, I'm down to fuck tonight. It's not romantic. And a lot of it is very childish as well. This was an ongoing sort of fairly amicable argument I used to have with an ex. And he was dead set that Percy Bysshe Shelley was one of the greatest poets who'd ever lived. Probably because he himself was a genuinely quite a romantic person. I was like, okay, Byron was a bastard, but I actually prefer his poetry. It feels more authentic and honest. Mm. And I was subjected to a very, very long lecture about why Percy Bysshe Shelley was better. And then we got to the end of it and he's like, so, do you see what I mean? I said, yeah, I see why you think it's that, but I'm still with Byron. And lest anyone think that I am bedazzled by Byron, Byron was a truly terrible person.
Really awful.
He was violent, he was unprincipled, he was often drunken, he was paranoid, he was insecure, he raped his wife when he was drunk. He was an awful, awful person. And, you know, whenever life threw something tragic at him, he kind of deserved it.
Yeah.
But he still wrote better poetry than Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Yeah. So, and then it wasn't very long after that Percy actually died. He drowned in a boating accident. And while for the most part it was ruled to be an accident, there was speculation that it might have been suicide or murder, but it does appear like most likely it was just an accident and the boat happened to sink. His body washed ashore and after, you know, a brief investigation, it was burned on the beach. Edward Trelawney was there and Byron was there and, you know, Byron couldn't stomach the burning, so he sort of walked off. Meanwhile, Edward Trelawney watched the whole thing, and apparently, when things had sort of cooled down, he reached in and he took Percy's calcified heart and he brought it to Mary. Mary obviously wasn't at the proceedings because during those times, women didn't really go to funerals. They were sort of kept away from it all. So he presented this calcified heart to Mary, who apparently kept it in her writing desk from that point onwards. Now, this is where things get a little bit interesting, because people tend to just sort of go, oh, okay, so that was it for Mary, as it were. But that wasn't really where her adventure ended. Now, there is quite a lot of evidence to suggest that Mary Shelley was a bisexual woman. She fell into the arms of another woman following Percy's death, though that is just rumour and speculation, and we don't necessarily have any guarantee that that definitely happened. But there is a letter she wrote to Edward Trelawney, basically saying that because, you know, she had a fear of men, she was likely to get tousy-mousy with women. And there's a lot of debate about what tousy-mousy means. but there is also the fact that she allegedly helped a lesbian couple escape to France together, securing them false passports so that they could live as man and wife together. She also was blackmailed on 3 separate occasions. Which, again, all the drama. She was just a lot of drama happening with Mary Shelley. She eventually moved in with her son and his wife, and they lived in...
No, wait. Go back a bit. Why was she blackmailed?
Well, so there was three times. One I know of in particular was that an Italian man, whom she'd considered her friends, threatened to expose some letters containing sensitive material to the world. Now, I don't know if she wrote those letters to him, or if he intercepted those letters from someone else. No one actually knows what was in those letters, because they were destroyed. So apparently something, they must have come to some kind of agreement and settlement. I'm not sure about the other two times that she was blackmailed, but certainly she was the victim of lots of people basically trying to get money that she didn't really have out of her, and trying to expose sort of dark secrets. Mary Shelley obviously spent a large amount of time following Percy's death trying to get herself reintroduced back into polite society, which was very difficult because her reputation was essentially in tatters, and even though she was recognised as an author, you know, people didn't forget and they didn't really forgive. She didn't do this for her own sake, but rather for the sake of her son, whom she wanted to give the best possible life to. And again, this is why I really don't like Percy Shelley, because he didn't even consider things like that, did he? He just did what he wanted, and he never even thought about the consequences for other people. It was just all about what his, you know... I was going to say something very rude there, but I'm just going to hold it in.
No, he was a classic post-phylactic. He followed his dick everywhere.
He really did.
It's worth mentioning, you know, obviously you've talked about Percy's death, etc. But he'd actually left Mary, or told her he'd left her before any of that happened, and run off with yet another young woman.
Yeah. So...
So all his love is eternal poetry is, you know, especially laughable.
Yeah. Giant, massive dick. Just a huge dick. Which is why it's really laughable that, you know, Byron, when Percy died, was just like, oh, he was such a good person. There was never as good a person as Percy. And I was like, oh, mate.
It's a bit, what's your basis for...
Really, Byron?
So what's your basis for comparison? If it's yourself, then yes, I suppose you've got a point.
Mary's later life was dogged with ill health. She developed a brain tumour, which caused her to have terrible headaches, and eventually caused partial paralysis as well. And she died when she was just 53 years old, which is very young.
Yes.
But yeah, so there we go. This is a brief rundown of Mary Shelley's life, basically just showing that her life was almost a gothic novel onto itself. You know, she really is the epitome of the gothic. I feel quite confident when I say she's kind of the queen of the gothic, because as I said, I wanted to put that in the title, but Jules mentioned that there might be some other female writers who may contest that. And that's fair enough. There can be several queens, but I really do think of her as the queen of the gothic, because when I think of the gothic, Mary Shelley just immediately springs to mind. You've got that taboo, you've got that tragedy, you've got that sensuality and sex and love. It's just, it's all there. It's good stuff, guys.
Definitely. So, why is Frankenstein so seminal? Why is it such an important work? To both sci-fi and the horror and gothic genres unto themselves. And I think the thing is, you know, you could just package and certainly when it's boiled down, Frankenstein just gets packaged as, you know, typical body horror in a lot of ways. And it's about so much more than that, and its strong themes still resonate with us today 200 years later. If you think how difficult many people find to read, say, Pride and Prejudice, which was largely contemporary to Frankenstein, and the fact that Frankenstein is often found easier or more accessible in story form, that says a lot about its themes. So let's have a look at some of those themes and why they're important and why they're now still being constantly re-examined through science fiction and through horror.
Yeah. So I think the first one is the most obvious, which is this idea of be careful what you wish for, and that very typical, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. The scientists were so concerned about whether they could do it, they didn't think about whether it was right.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a theme that just appears over and over and over again, and it really encapsulates that fear that we have of the future rushing towards us. Now remember the period that Mary Shelley was living in, there was suddenly, you know, these huge leaps and bounds happening in medicine and in science, and it was actually happening very, very fast. And in the same way, we express that kind of fear in, first of all, there was this fear of genetic mutation, which is where you get things like Jurassic Park coming in. And now there's this fear of, you know, computers and creating artificial intelligence. So we have all these stories about the machine rising up against us. And it has been a continual theme throughout our literature. And it's just the epitome of our fear of what's coming and what we might unleash.
Yeah, it's sort of a fear of part of our own natures, because it is human nature to strive and to wonder and to imagine and then to try and create what we wonder and imagine. And yet at the same time, it's not always safe to go ahead and do that, because we are children. We are babies playing with loaded guns a lot of the time. And, you know, that's something that Frankenstein absolutely encapsulates. I think there is also one of the themes I particularly like in Frankenstein is one that seems to have gone over most of Mary Shelley's contemporary male associates' heads, and that is, who is the monster and who is the man? Mm. And I still maintain that Victor Frankenstein is actually the monster of that piece.
He really is. The thing is that there's actually so many feminist threads throughout Frankenstein. It's hilarious.
And it's just gone right past them. Like, they've read it and gone, oh, this is terrifying. How did this come out of a young girl's brain? It's like, no, this is her life as she's living it. You just don't understand.
Yeah. I do like this idea that it's, you know, it's this idea that Frankenstein basically said, I shall create a man. And instead of going about it in the way that most other people go about it, he's like, no, I alone shall create a man. Women are not required. You do not need a uterus. I shall merely use dead body parts. And of course it goes about as well as you'd expect. Except the thing is that it might have gone absolutely fine. There was literally no reason for half of the book to have happened. And it's all because Frankenstein, and it's funny there because I almost said Percy Shelley, which I think is wrong. instead of taking responsibility for what he'd done, he freaked out and he ran away.
And just left it.
And he just left it.
Abandoned a child. That's a very telling thread in itself. That's a case of a man may create a child and then go, ah, I don't want to take responsibility for this, and just leave the child. And then whatever happens is partially that man who is abandoned. The first significant relationship is with your parents. If your parents abandon you, it follows you through your entire life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very telling thing there. And I can't believe that just went, like Lord Byron, straight over his head like an aeroplane. Same with Shelley. Yeah. Same with everyone else.
Yeah, they took it very literally, and it didn't look, well, no, okay, let's look at this. Let's really examine.
Maybe you should take responsibility for all these illegitimate children you're creating and the poor women you leave ruined in your wake after your pretty words and your attentions have ceased.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, it also comes into the fact that the monster is a monster because he's perceived to be as such. And this perception warps him into being that monster. But there is nothing actually ingrained within him which makes him monstrous. Everything monstrous about him has been basically put on him by, first of all, Frankenstein, who stitched him together using body parts. But then also by the other people who are afraid of him, who throw him out. And it actually is this, you know, this thread of we make our own demons. We make our own monsters. If you treat someone badly over and over and over again, they are going to come back to bite you.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, that's three of the really strong threads that run through Frankenstein. A slightly subtler one for me, and it's one that is tied up with grief and loss and coping with these things in a way that is ultimately healthy. And also being allowed to grieve, I think, being genuinely allowed to grieve, is it looks at the God complex inherent in trying to conquer death. So, you know, I think there is other than sort of the possibility of reanimating dead flesh by applying an electrical current, which was something that being speculated at the time, and we since know is actually true, in terms of we've tried it with frogs and various other animals. And it's the whole, you know, why did she choose dead bodies? Why didn't she choose a whole dead child or a whole dead person? Why didn't she just try to reanimate something like that rather than stitching bits and pieces together to create something new? And I think it is this idea of, you know, I've lost something and what I wouldn't give for it to come back and to be alive in any form whatsoever. And yet I know that there's something unnatural about not that feeling, but in actually acting upon it. And a man arrogant enough to do that, to play God in that way, would be a very dangerous person.
Yeah. There's also another side to it, which is the idea of man creating perfection. And again, I think, and again, this is me just speculating, and I do see a lot of Percy Shelley in Frankenstein as a character. And the idea that Percy also, I think, he reflected what he wanted to see on other people. He kind of created this perfect image in his mind, which allowed him to become sort of obsessively in love. And it's something that people do all the time. They sort of cast out their fantasies on a human being rather than actually falling in love with them. And there's an element of that in Frankenstein. Frankenstein builds this perfect human being. He builds it up. He picks all the best parts of everything that he can find to create something which is going to be perfect. But the reality does not stand up. And when he looks at what he's created, he suddenly finds that it's not what he actually wants. It's not what he actually loves. And each individual thing that he decided was perfect, it doesn't work. It doesn't actually work altogether. And so for me, it really does also feel like facing reality when you've sort of pushed your feelings or your thoughts and your projections onto a person, only to discover that that's not actually who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose our final point on this little section is that now in sci-fi and horror and the gothic, whenever someone writes about pushing boundaries, whether we're talking scientific boundaries, medical boundaries, societal norms, or sexual boundaries quite often as well, I've actually written, you'll find Frankenstein lurking not too far away, which is an amusing image, but is actually quite true, I think.
Yes. Sorry, I really, really like this idea where you're just giving a lecture and you look over and there's just this sort of dishevelled man just crouching nearby. Victor, get out! No, you're not meant to be here, get out! He hisses and scurries away.
I mean, I think that was something that really struck me. Admittedly, I have not read Frankenstein for about 20 years. I really ought to read it again. But what struck me about the book when I did read it was the fact that sex and death are all tied up together, and there is a very sexual component to Frankenstein, not in an obvious way, but in the sense of, if you take, you know, the woman who becomes Elizabeth Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein's wife, and compare her with the monster he creates, it's almost like a young man going off to college in those days and having lots of unsatisfactory sexual encounters and discovering that what he actually wants was what his family wanted from him in the first place.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the whole component of creation and creating a child and something belonging to you and therefore being your responsibility. Again, there's a twisted sexual component to that as well.
There's also a homoerotic component as well. Creating the perfect man for Victor. It's not like he said, I'm going to create a life, and he decided to sort of make a baby. He didn't want a baby. He wanted a man. He wanted a perfect man. And as someone pointed out, Victor chose each individual part to be absolutely perfect. So he would go through bodies and bodies to try and find the perfect bit, which meant that Victor spent a considerable amount of time looking for the perfect penis, guys, for his creation. So I'm not saying it's gay, but
I mean,
it's a bit
gay.
That
could have been an accidental thing, or that could have been Mary Shelley going, oh, they're not getting the rest of it, so I'm going to put this in as well, because this is going to be really funny. So, to finish off, let's look at some things that have actually been inspired by Frankenstein. Since we're now talking about homoeroticism and pushing sexual boundaries, let's just mention the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Which very clearly takes a little bit of tongue-in-cheek inspiration from Frankenstein.
Yes.
You obviously have your Brad and Janet, who are your all-American couple, who get lost on the way home and caught in the storm, and they find a spooky mansion. Nothing can possibly go wrong if they just spend the night there. Their host is a little bit strange, but, you know, he seems fairly affable. And from there, it just becomes one big, very queer, very gender-bendy, erotic adventure. Obviously, Dr. Frankenfurter has been doing a little bit of Frankensteining himself in his underground lab and literally create himself the perfect man in the form of Rocky. Once again, this also... They neatly reverse the idea. So yes, everything is played for laughs, and everything is played very deliberately to shock the very conservative values that it was coming up against at the time. I think Rocky Horror Picture Show got banned in quite a lot of states. It's like, well, not least because it suggests that Frankenfurter had time to seduce not just Janet but also Brad at the same time, and then, you know, after a quiet cigarette, went down and reanimated his perfect man. Frankenfurter just did not quit at all, and it is very peculiar, but it's also very funny, and I like the way that it's kind of... It's Dr. Frankenfurter who's running after Rocky, and Rocky's kind of like, okay, I'm created, and oh god, you've created me to be your what? Your fuck toy? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I'm not being given a choice in this. I prefer Janet. I think it would be very easy to look at that and say this is just something silly that was pushing it for shock value at the time. When in fact it's also looking at things like consent and the fact that lots of different types of desires are okay, and that pushing gender boundaries is normal and healthy, and that, you know, you don't have to be so black and white in your sexuality. You don't have to be straight or nothing, which was which were the options at the time. And all of that has come from Frankenstein.
Yeah. So that's something you might not have expected.
Yeah, you wouldn't. And weirdly, I feel like if Mary Shelley had been alive to see it, she'd have been nodding with approval, you know. So yeah, yes, let's dress men in suspender belts. This is great. This is a good idea.
Mary Shelley would thrive in today's society. She really would. So another one is The Dark Descent of Elizabeth Frankenstein.
Yeah, that's by... her name went out of my head. That's Kirsten White. Kirsten White has written some great retakes on things. She did a gender-bent version of Dracula, but looking at it from, you know, the position of it actually having been Vlad Tepes. So it was more of a historical gender-bend type thing. This is... you know, Frankenstein, but from the perspective of the sweet and doomed Elizabeth Frankenstein. how she was taken into Victor's house as a young girl as a companion for him. And it really plays Victor off as a total sociopath. So I won't say it necessarily does anything new, but I think it repackages the values and the themes of Frankenstein in a way that is really interesting for today.
Sorry. I love the fact that you... Sorry. I love the fact that you you say it plays Victor off as a total sociopath. So it doesn't really change anything in the story.
Well, I don't think it does, because he comes across as a sociopath to me, even before they'd coined the term. But...
Yeah.
I don't think we're supposed to like Victor Frankenstein or sympathise with him very much.
No, though his mate Henry is so sweet.
Yeah, that all goes horribly wrong. That all goes horribly wrong as well.
I know it does. I just want an entire thing about him.
You might have to write it yourself.
I might have to, because he was just a genuinely nice person. Like, what if he'd met the creature and befriended it?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because in The Dark Descent of Elizabeth Frankenstein, it does change the ending somewhat, and it kind of works. Anyway, it's a really good book. It's a good take on the story, and I highly recommend it. I particularly liked the portrayal of Frankenstein's monster done in the Penny Dreadfuls. The proper London set series.
Yes. I really, really enjoyed it as well. I liked Frankenstein in that story as well, to be honest. I liked him better than in others. He is still a bit... Well, he's very odd. You'd have to be pretty odd to just start to unbury human beings. But there does seem to be more of a sort of a logic behind why he's doing it. The creature in... The Penny Dreadful Frankenstein is wonderful, and I particularly like him because, unlike a lot of very modern adaptations of Frankenstein, where you have Frankenstein and the creature sort of being mixed together, and it's this huge, lumbering, square-headed man with bolts, you know, in his neck.
Classic Hammer horror.
Instead of that, you have this creature who I think he takes on the name Caliban. Yeah. Who speaks so eloquently, like in the actual original book. And I particularly like it because basically Caliban learned to speak by reading all this classic literature. So he has this wonderful turn of phrase, and he's very charismatic, but he's also violent at times and, quite scary, but I just thought that it was just beautifully
done. He's terrible because his loneliness and his sense of abandonment and his alienation is terrible, and therefore he does terrible things. But at the same time, he's an incredibly poignant character. The bit that gets me is when he's sort of, you know, retiring, he's hidden almost underground, and he meets the blind girl, I think it is, and she's talking about poetry, and he starts talking about, I don't know if you like John Clare, but I love John Clare's poetry. But he used to, you know, I am, yet what I am, none knows nor cares. Friends forsake me like a memory lost. I am the self-consumer of my woes. They rise above me, an oblivious host, tossed into the nothingness of sound and noise. And it's talking about, again, that sense of abandonment, of being disconnected from everything around you. They genuinely couldn't have picked a more perfect poem to completely encapsulate that poignant, terrible sense of being disconnected from everything.
Yeah. I'm not going to go into what happens in that, but it's beautiful. It's very, very well done. So Penny Dreadful, big tick for Frankenstein from me there. Of course, Frankenstein, and I say Frankenstein now rather than the creature, because there's just been this irreparable sort of merger now between the pair of them. You get that in episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer as well.
Yeah, there's the it's sort of a classic way of looking at grief. So a very smart kid bringing back his dead brother, his dead brother being reanimated, using bits of other corpses and things, and then, you know, him having been this handsome football star, now relegated to lurking in the basement, hoping his brother will create a bride for him that is, you know, a sufficient beauty but also ugliness and weirdness that, you know, she'll be happy to stay with him. And once again, it's questioning that anything you make belongs always and eternally to itself, but you still have responsibility for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Then, of course, is Amy's academicals.
Yeah, I never obviously envisaged the fact that I would be writing a very, very long series about Amy's adventures where she stars as the main character. So she was supposed to just have this one novella where she got to do something by herself. And yes, I had her go off to a physics or science camp on the shore of Lake Geneva, and there's something weird in the lake, and it's all connected to the happenings at Villa Diodati, and with Amy's own sort of unrealized and burgeoning sexuality herself, because, you know, she figures out some stuff while she's there that she hasn't been aware of before.
She certainly does.
And that all seemed to fit in with sort of the whole Frankenstein thing, and you know, the only thing about that I really regret is even though it's not real, is destroying one of Mary Shelley's manuscripts in that story. I was writing, it was like, oh God, I can't do it. This is awful.
You've got to do it.
So yeah, that was a fun little take, and I definitely borrowed from some of the themes. And I've realised that I've actually borrowed again from some of the themes for later in this series, particularly with the third book, which Madeline's just read.
Yes. I've been super really enjoying this series so far. I've just sort of gobbled them up in a matter of days, and then I'm like, it's just me slapping on the desk, Jules, book four, where's book four?
So yeah, it's fun. And this is kind of what we're getting at. The themes from Frankenstein are eternal, or, you know, as near as damn it is to swearing. So they appear in everything, and I wasn't necessarily consciously thinking I'm going to draw on these themes, and it's only looking at them that makes me see that actually that is absolutely what I've done. I think you've done it too, particularly in Blood of the Delphi.
Oh, you noticed.
It's kind of like, okay, some of that has a very Frankenstein feel.
Well, the whole bringing someone back from the dead thing. And then it maybe not going entirely right.
It's almost like if you
who'd have thought?
It's like if you bring someone back from the dead now, in fiction, not in real life. In fact, don't do it in real life, guys, please. It cannot go right. There's a reason there are checks and balances like this.
You know, I'm going to write a story where it does go right, where everything's just absolutely fine. You bring them back from the dead and it's like, whew, oh, that was a bit strange. Right, back to work.
I think you're going to find that unless you balance the scales, that it's not going to feel very satisfying, and you're going to have to make things go wrong. No.
So yeah, we're nearing the end of the episode, but I think we really do need to reiterate just what an impact Frankenstein and Mary Shelley have had on literature, on the tropes. I mean, not only just beginning an entirely new genre, but also within other genres as well.
Yeah, so obviously we've talked about the themes, but certainly things like wrestling with morality. Should I do it? I can do this. I could be great, but should I do it? That's something that comes up a lot. Dealing with grief and loss in a rather unhealthy way, in a I shall conquer death kind of way.
Because that's the thing about Victor Frankenstein. He's not just creating life, he's conquering death. And that's where it starts to get a bit creepy. you know, and then there's also the whole idea of the weighing the selfish needs of the individual versus the careful exercise of power for the benefit of all. You know, is this, I'm doing this because it will benefit everyone, or is this about me? Let's not lie, Victor Frankenstein was doing it for Victor
Frankenstein. It was a quest for personal significance for him as much as anything else. And that was something that the Mary Shelley clearly abhorred. She endorsed her father's beliefs that power should be carefully exercised to produce the best results for the greatest number of people, you know, which was considered quite an anarchist viewpoint for the time, when we were still living with the hangover of noble stock meant that you were of noble character kind of thing.
Also because there was a double standard there with William Godwin saying, yes, yes, all of this about power and stuff like that, and all of this about free love. He was a believer in free love. He didn't extend that courtesy of to his daughter.
Definitely. And I suppose it's the things that, you know, really affect us personally about the story. But for me, one of the themes is, you know, the oppressive loneliness that turns someone vicious. In a sense of it's beyond the Wuthering Heights nature versus nurture type story. This is a case of, this is someone who, and I'm not talking about Victor Frankenstein, obviously, someone who is so fundamentally abandoned that they turn upon vice as an occupation. They turn upon revenge as an occupation. It's that entire quote, isn't it? Beware, for I am fearless and therefore powerful. It's like, you've taken everything. I have nothing left except my revenge. Therefore, I have nothing to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. Imposing that loneliness and ostracism on another is a terrible crime against basic human decency.
Right? Yes. Yeah, it's that you are responsible for the things you create. And I suppose that, you know, that could hit close to home if you decide to go ahead with the pregnancy and you don't necessarily want to keep the child and you're arranging for an adoption and things. That's obviously not necessarily what Mary Shelley was getting at. What she was largely getting at was the fact that, you know, you can believe in all these things, but if you go around impregnating young impressionable women, then really you should be acknowledging your children.
Yeah, absolutely. You are responsible for your actions, and consequences of those actions as well. And again, yeah, it was very much sort of aimed toward these, particularly these men who were just blithely going around ruining young women's lives and then basically taking none of the responsibility for it. On that cheery note,
it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and this week Madeline is going to field it.
Yes, and unsurprisingly to anyone, I'm actually going to recommend you read Frankenstein. What? No, I really do recommend that you read it. It is one of these classics. It is easier to read than things like Jane Austen, certainly. And it's actually not too long of a read, but there is a lot of content there which is very relevant to the modern day. It's a very moving story. It's a very beautiful story. It is quite creepy in places, certainly. And I do thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. So do give it a go. And please let us know what you think about it. Remember, you can get in touch with us on Twitter or on Facebook, both via our Dissecting Dragons pages or individually. And we really would love to hear from you. On that note, guys, we'll say thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.